Welcome to another episode of Conduct Detrimental. Dan Wallach, Dan Lust. Dan, happy Monday. How was your weekend? Big sports weekend.
Yeah, I mean, World Cup. And then the triple rarity of the New York Knicks, New York Giants, and New York Rangers all winning on the same day. When was the last time that happened? I think Bill Parcells might have been the Giants coach at the time. So it was a great weekend for sports, definitely.
I think the Knicks and Rangers have won seven straight. But Dan, even though this is a, you know, we're both native New Yorkers, some great games this weekend between the World Cup game. I think many are saying the greatest World Cup game of all time. You had the Bills game in the snow and some wild finishes in the NFL world. So let's just say it was a heavily bet weekend. How about that, Dan? Big sports betting weekend.
For sure. And we're not even getting into the ultimate craziness of a Bill Belichick coach team having a sort of a reverse lateral be returned for a touchdown, almost like reminiscent of the immaculate reception in reverse. Or for those Giant fans old enough to remember, Larry Zonker fumbling the handoff from Joe Pisarcik, and it should have been a kneel down to clinch the game in 1976, and Herman Edwards went all the way to the house. I think it was Herman Edwards on a return fumble. This was probably one of the three craziest endings in the history of professional or college football. I would put that right up there with the Stanford marching band.
The band is on the field. No band in that Raiders-Patriot ending, but certainly was up there. But yeah, wild weekend.
Intentional infliction of emotional distress.
It was.
That's the legal angle.
Certainly was. Okay, so Dan, we have two topics on the docket today. You were hard at work over the weekend with two interviews. Two topics really on the docket. Then we have obviously some other items to address. But number one is a story that, Dan, you and I have kind of spoke about in the background for some time now, dating back I think probably maybe 2 years. But Barstool is now owned 100% by Penn National Gaming. So we've talked about Barstool in the NIL context.
We will be in 2023 right now.
They've agreed in principle to buy 100% for an evaluation of $387 million. But why we bring it up, Barstool is a content creator in the kind of gambling adjacent space, gambling space. So we thought in the NIL space it would cause some issues. And now, Dan, you're obviously at the heart of it. It is causing some issues on the legislative and the legal gambling space. So, you know, that's number one. Obviously, we're going to talk about an upcoming hearing that's going to happen over in Massachusetts, but that's topic number one. And number two, this was a story that I know caught your attention. Offensive line coach Sean Kugler for the Arizona Cardinals was kind of like fired out of nowhere in a trip to Mexico City when the Cardinals had a game over there. And all of a sudden, Kugler files an arbitration filing, basically saying that maybe there was a case of mistaken identity. So we'll talk about that. We're going to have two great guests on, Charlie McIntyre, as well as former guest of the show, Howard Balzer. But before we get to our guests, a reminder, our podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review, top bar prep company in the galaxy. We are heading to holiday season. Give the gift of Themis. Use our promo code CONDUCT for a lot of money off. I was about to say $20 off, but it's actually a lot more than $20. And if you ever have any questions about Themis, we're like pseudo brand ambassadors for them. So feel free to reach out and we're happy to guide you on all fronts. Okay, Dan, before we get to the first topic, which is Barstool and your guest, Charlie McIntyre, anything that's crossing your radar that our listeners should know about?
Sure. But I want you to know, Dan, how committed I am to the podcast. I made one of the worst television viewing decisions in my entire life. It will never be topped. I'm so committed to this podcast that I interviewed Charlie McIntyre and Howard Balzer back to back during the World Cup final of Argentina against France. I missed the greatest sporting event ever played. I watched the penalty kick, the penalties at the end, but I'm kicking myself today, no pun intended, because I scheduled these interviews at probably the worst possible time from a sports viewing experience. In fact, if you listen closely during the Charlie McIntyre interview, his son, who's watching the soccer match in a separate room, screams at a couple of different junctures during the game. And it's not because Charlie, you know, hit him over the head or anything, but it's because Argentina scored. And all day today, I've been ruining that decision because it's really, you know, self-inflicted, you know, it's a self-inflicted wound. I had no reason to schedule calls at that time of the day. I could have made it any time I wanted and I'll never get this game back again. So as a result, I refuse to watch any other soccer match for time immemorial because nothing could ever top how riveting that game appeared to be from reading about it after the fact. What's in my world this week?
Well, I was going to say, well, Dan, let's hang there for a second. You said maybe the greatest game of all time. It was obviously, I think, an all-time classic, right? But it was probably one of the most watched all-time classics of all time. So you're going to have to talk about that in the conversation of greatest games of all time. Mbappe sure. gets a hat trick. You know, you have Messi and Mbappe, two of the greatest players in their respective sport, one kind of on his way out, one kind of upcoming. So had all the different storylines. So yeah, we watched that. I had a room full of family members kind of like saying, this is the worst World Cup game of all time. And I think Clint Dempsey said at halftime that 2-0 is the most dangerous lead in sports for a reason. You can kind of get lulled to sleep. So right around the 70th minute, it went from worst World Cup game of all time to very quickly the greatest World Cup game of all time. And that's why we love sports, Dan.
Well, I guess I only feel bad now about missing the final 20 minutes.
Yes, but, yes.
That's mind-boggling. In fact, I know Howard wasn't watching the World Cup, but Charlie was. And I get a sense that Charlie was eager to get back to watching the World Cup game. So that was that debacle. Last week, however, was a different debacle of a slightly different kind. The sports betting oral argument before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. For those of you who follow the saga around the legalization of sports betting in Florida, you might recall in 2021, the governor of Florida and the Seminole Tribe agreed on what's known as a Class 3 gaming compact to give the Seminole Tribe of Florida a statewide monopoly over sports betting, both in person at Indian Land and mobile over the internet, where they would get to control it. That compact was challenged in federal court by a paramutual betting operator known as West Flagler, and I've been really beating the drum for the past year and a half that this compact was going to get thrown out because it authorizes gambling outside of Indian lands in violation of IGRA. Clear cut, one of the easiest decisions that any judge could ever make. And of course, the district court judge in Washington, D.C. threw it out on precisely those grounds. But last week, however, the oral argument before a three-judge panel of the D.C. Court of Appeals had a different feel to it. In nearly an hour and a half of oral argument, I never once heard the word server or the actual merits of the case. The oral argument focused on issues of whether the Seminole Tribe should have had the right to intervene in the underlying lawsuit so that they could challenge or seek the dismissal of the case on the basis of sovereign immunity. So there are all these issues that had little to do with the ultimate merits of the case, but the judge, or at least one of the judges, who is the chief judge or the majority judge, or I'm sorry, majority is the wrong word. He was the dominant judge on the three-judge panel. And it seemed pretty clear to me from his comments and how he phrased his questions that it's highly likely he's going to vote in favor of reversing the lower court decision. And I think his name is Judge Robert Wilkins, an appointee of President Barack Obama. One of the other judges, I forgot her name, I think it's Henderson. She was an appointee of George Herbert Walker Bush, a Republican nominee, and she seemed to be siding with affirming the lower court decision. So the future of Florida sports betting may ultimately hinge on the vote of the third judge, Judge Childs, who's an appointee of President Joe Biden, whose agency's decision in this case from the Department of the Interior is favoring the compact. So ultimately, this could go either way, but if you look at it through the lens of who the political or judicial appointees are, you may see a situation here where the Seminole Tribe, miraculously against the weight of or against the merits here, is able to successfully overturn the lower court's decision, and we could be on a path to legal sports betting before the end of 2023. In all likelihood, however, and this will close the point, I think this is going to go all the way to the United States Supreme Court. So this three-judge panel will not be the final word on the issue. Whoever or whichever is the non-prevailing party, be it the Seminole Tribe or West Flagler, they're probably going to seek a petition for rehearing en banc and have the full D.C. Circuit decide the case, because it is a question of national importance, exceptional public importance, because the ability of tribes and states to compact for online sports betting outside of Indian lands is a benefit or a gambling entitlement that tribes nationwide would love to have. And of course, it would operate to the detriment of non-tribal gaming operators who could be in the position someday where the tribes in their states may try to accomplish statewide monopolies through the structure of a Class 3 gaming compact on the basis of this decision, which might allow states and tribes to include internet sports wagering or internet gaming in general within the ambit of a Class 3 gaming compact. And it could totally turn the, you know, gaming industry on its head. So because this is a case of such exceptional importance beyond the parties at issue, I think it gets reheard en banc and ultimately goes to the United States Supreme Court. So that's a case we're going to follow very closely here. And I wouldn't be shocked if by February, March, or April, we get a decision reversing the lower court ruling.
So obviously, we're going to keep tabs on that. Dan, I'm always fascinated with all these various legal battles in the world of sports betting. And I think that brings us to Barstool, which, you know, obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, I imagine you're a podcast person. I am as well. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to a handful of Barstool podcasts. So, you know, as we move to our first topic, I'm very familiar with what Barstool does, and we alluded to it a little bit. But Barstool is in the content game on a number of different levels, right? They have a podcast dedicated to psychedelics, to, you know, they do a lot of stuff, obviously, with alcohol. They have a Barstool as their logo. They're associated with, you know, with you pick your spot. Barstool is involved with it. They do some raunchy humor and whatnot. For our purposes, though, what Barstool does, they're very much in the sports betting content game. Dan, you know, we were talking about it a little bit, and there's some good literature out there, but Barstool is now kind of in like the live event space. So in addition to putting Instagram content out and TikTok content and Twitter content, they're now hosting like their own version of College Game Day, where a lot of this gets started by an event that they had over at Toledo University and comments that they were making to college kids, not all of which are 21. So, you know, I'm going to let you take the bull by the horns. You're their sports betting guy, or you're the sports betting guru here. But I do find it interesting for Penn. And just here's some brief background. I think people should know this. In 2020, right at the beginning of the pandemic, I remember this coming out. Penn pays 100, Penn National Gaming, huge betting company. They want really a face for their kind of their betting initiative. So obviously, unless you're living under a rock, the main two players in the space, and I have a lot of family members, friends that bet, the main two sites they use are DraftKings and FanDuel. So Penn maybe saw the writing on the wall and they said, you know what? We want to align ourselves with Barstool. That has built-in brand equity. So what are we going to do? We're going to buy 36% of the company, the whole company, for $163 million. And then they invest another $62 million. They had an option to acquire a 50% stake. And then they felt that the partnership was going so well that they agreed, and Dan, you are right, they're going to purchase the remaining 100% of the company by February of 2023 for a total valuation of $387 million. So that's it. Penn has decided to basically, you know, lack of a better term, they're getting into bed with Barstool. That's it. They've hitched their wagon to Barstool, and they're now in it for the long run. But that obviously comes with some potential problems. So Dan, I will kick it to you. You had on a guest, Charlie McIntyre, this week. We have some big decisions coming up on the Barstool Penn front, but you know, nobody can explain it better than you. But that's the background that we're dealing with.
Well, you know, the timing is everything in the world of sports betting legalization sometimes. And Penn Entertainment and Barstool Sports, the sports book, have been licensed in at least 13 jurisdictions for sports betting. But now we're about to come up to the first state or commonwealth that is really going to scrutinize very closely the relationship between Penn National, which is now called Penn Entertainment, Barstool Sportsbook, and Barstool Sports, the media brand, as part of the licensing process, because Penn National owns a casino in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts known as it's called the Plainridge Park Casino. It's owned by Penn National, and they have an in-house, in-casino branded Barstool Sportsbook. And of course, as a casino operator within the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, they also have the right to offer that brand over the internet as part of the Barstool Digital Sportsbook. So the question of Barstool's suitability has come up in some recent Massachusetts Gaming Commission public meetings. There was one on December 6th. And the timing of that meeting occurred 2 weeks after the New York Times dropped a series of articles that were unflattering, to say the least, to the sports betting industry. One of those articles focused on Dave Portnoy, and it was a piece written by Emily Steele titled "Desperate for Growth, Aging Casino Company Embraced Degenerate Gambler." And that's a story that details Dave Portnoy's financial history. He declared bankruptcy, had gambling debts, and basically goes through the whole litany of, I guess, past accusations involving Dave Portnoy. And that got on the radar of the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, because when they determine a gaming company's suitability for licensing, they look at everything. They look at the financial history. They look at integrity-related issues. But more importantly, at the front end, they determine who's going to be subject to this suitability determination? Is it just the applicant? Is it going to be Plain Ridge Park Casino, which is owned by Penn? Is it just going to be the Barstool Sportsbook, which is separate from the media brand? Or will they also consider the suitability of those marketing agents and promoters of the Barstool Sportsbook? And I think this is where the story, I guess, begins with the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, because at the December 6th Massachusetts Gaming Committee public meeting, that was the initial consideration of a Plain Ridge Park casino license. And 4 hours into this meeting, the commissioners began making a number of statements and troubling comments and commentaries about Barstool. One commissioner, Ellen O'Brien, I said she was concerned about the historical marketing, history. I'm disturbed by that. Commissioner Skinner said something about the elephant in the room. We're at a crossroads. So now the issue is whether Barstool, and in particular Dave Portnoy, are going to be subject to a deep probing suitability determination, which gaming companies are normally subjected to, but not necessarily the marketing agents. And on December 20th, which is tomorrow or maybe today, Dan, the Gaming Commission is going to decide whether to license Plain Ridge Park Casino. And they're going to focus heavily on the relationship between Barstool Sportsbook, Penn National, with the media company and Mr. Portnoy. So this is the first time that's really happened.
The argument that we're having now about, like, should Barstool be associated with Penn? I feel in my core that it's kind of like the old conversation we were having, like, should college athletes be paid, right? Like, it's taboo. We shouldn't be doing that. And then, like, you kind of look in the rearview mirror now that we're like a year and a half into this college sports era. And it's like, well, maybe that old era was just wrong. And there was this kind of this taboo that was put over, the wool over ours by the NCAA that college athletes shouldn't be paid. And as I'm reading, Dan, there's a story I alluded to with the Toledo University live event that Barstool holds. Barstool sports betting became legal in Ohio on January 1st. So they're at this Toledo, university event. They're holding kind of like a, raucous college sports event, and they're kind of promoting gambling, right? They're promoting, their Penn National Gaming and whatnot. I'm saying Penn National, but the Barstool Sportsbook, the actual platform. And it comes out like, listen, you are now preaching to an audience that some of which is under 21. So Barstool, I don't know if it's official yet, but they were facing a fine of at least $250,000 by the Ohio Casino Control Commission. So, why I bring this all up, and I'm like, it's now 2022. Like, it's a different model. Like, people are talking about gambling and sports betting. Like, Major League Baseball has official partners. And the NFL, Dan, I was watching over the weekend, it said, like, Caesars Sportsbook, a official sponsor of the NFL. It wasn't like the official sponsor. It was like one of many. So if these sports leagues are talking about sports betting, we have commercials for sports betting by the leagues that are sponsored by the leagues. Like, I don't know, we're really going to fine Barstool or fine Penn $250,000 for speaking openly about sports betting? So I think we're right at this crux here of the two eras, right? Maybe they're going to be fine. Maybe Massachusetts is going to, give them a tongue lashing. But I feel like we're right here where the tide might turn or it might not.
Well, it goes a little bit further than that, according to the notice of a violation. They weren't just talking about sports betting and generally promoting sports betting. They were allegedly promoting pre-registration for the Barstool Sportsbook in a venue in which it's pretty reasonable or safe to assume that more than 25% of the intended audience at a university is below the age of 21. That's the issue. And that came up repeatedly, or at least it came up not only in the Ohio Casino Control Commission notice, but it came up during the course of the December 6th Massachusetts Gaming Commission meeting. They also referred to Dave Portnoy's appearance at University of Tennessee, where he discussed wagering $100,000 on the team's opponent that day, University of Georgia, to win the national championship. And they've got the history of, sort of the irreverence surrounding the Barstool site and whom their audience is and the way they do not promote responsible gambling. And that was a matter of great concern to at least three of the commissioners on the record. So we're going to find out later today what the fallout from that is, because I think there's a realistic prospect that Plain Ridge Park Casino will be denied a retail sports betting license without having some type of severance from Barstool, or alternatively, there could be sort of probationary type conditions to ensure future adherence. And I think they're going to get the benefit of the doubt because Penn National has an excellent reputation for responsible gaming generally, and they're an in-state casino. So it would seem unfathomable to me that an in-state casino would not be able to have a gambling license or for a sports betting license, but there may be some conditions on licensure attached to that license.
So certainly an interesting conversation. And Dan, you had on Charlie McIntyre, the executive director of the New Hampshire Lottery, friend of the show. So yeah, Dan, I mean, I think we've laid it out pretty well. So anything else to add before we kick it to Charlie? I mean, I think we've addressed it.
No, but this is really going to have a channeling effect, major channeling effect on Barstool in other jurisdictions, because if you get dinged in one jurisdiction, that could act as a door opener to revisiting that issue and inquiry in other gaming jurisdictions. So what happens before one commission has a carryover effect in numerous other state, you know, gaming regulatory bodies. So that's something to watch both in the short term. Imagine Barstool not being able to participate in the state that gave birth to it.
Would not look good. And obviously that's why you guys tune into the podcast to listen to some issue spotting. So that's the issue spotting, right? And that fun IRAC method. Now here is some analysis and potentially some conclusions with Charlie McIntyre, again, executive director of the New Hampshire Lottery.
Okay, making his debut on the Conduct Detrimental podcast. Somebody I've known for several years. He's become a good friend of mine in the gaming space, as well as the academic space. And just in the world generally, my good friend, Charlie McIntyre. For those who don't know Charlie, he's the executive director of the New Hampshire Lottery Commission. He's basically the top regulator for the state of New Hampshire on the issue of sports betting. And he lies next door to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which is going through a very elongated licensing and regulatory process to launch sports betting in time by March Madness in March of 2023. So Charlie, welcome to Conduct Detrimental.
Dan, thanks. I'm a big fan. Obviously, we're good friends. Thrilled to be on.
The situation brewing in Massachusetts, Penn Entertainment and Barstool, this is a question of, you couldn't have the worst possible timing to be applying for a gaming license in Massachusetts. You've got for a sports betting license in Massachusetts. You have a chairwoman of the Massachusetts Gaming Commission who walks the walk and talks the talk when it comes to responsible gambling and the issue of advertising permeating the airwaves. And that's happening at a point in time when the New York Times drops this story a couple of weeks ago on Dave Portnoy, Barstool, and the gambling and sports betting industry at large. And now a week or so ago, the Ohio Casino Control Commission has fined Barstool Ohio for conducting, you know, marketing campaigns directed at the University of Toledo or Toledo College campus, and actually, you know, targeting or directing advertising to an audience under the age of 21 or substantially under the age of 21 and pre-signing them up, right? Getting them registered. So how do you look at this issue from afar? You're next door, you're aware of, you know, Commissioner Judge Stein. Can you explain for me how these recent events surrounding Barstool taking place in Ohio, the New York Times, how does this impact the suitability of a company like Penn Entertainment, which operates the Plain Ridge Park Casino, which will be utilizing the Barstool sportsbook brand? What do you see transpiring here in Massachusetts in terms of licensing and suitability?
As you know, Kathy's a friend of mine, the chairwoman of the Mass Gaming Commission, and she is as straight as a human being can be. She really is. When you say walk the walk, talk the talk, she absolutely believes in the unyielding belief in regulation and honesty and fair play. And the brand of Barstool kind of is based around irreverence, right? Let's be honest here. Their sports has been, I don't say sports reporting and sports, just their belief in sports tends to be more tongue-in-cheek, you know, more irreverence, more just not serious reporting. They're not the New York Times of sports. They're sort of just irreverent. And so, you know, off-the-cuff comments live forever, right, in this day and age. And so the, you know, bet your house on it, I think is what he said, and his background is not going to be a play. I mean, as you know, Dan, regulators' offices are filled with ex-law enforcement. And, you know, they're the kind of guys who at the airport, when you're waiting to put your bag through, you don't tell jokes to, right? I once had a friend who was a trooper in the Logan Airport, and some guy thought he was funny saying he had a bomb in his bag. And that guy spent the next 6 hours in detainment, you know, being cavity searched. Like, not funny. Like, there's sometimes, and so gambling regulators are not known for having a sense of humor in terms of the belief in what they regulate. That's what you're, you know, you're, I apologize, Dan, the World Cup is on in the background and my youngest son is a huge fan. So
somebody must have just scored. I've been excommunicated from my office, which has the best Wi-Fi connection. And I'm now operating in the second bedroom. How does this come to a head in Massachusetts?
I mean, for me, it's one of those things where you would, there we, as all regulators do, we have issues with certain parties and principals, and they're asked to leave. So I'd be surprised if Barstool and or Mr. Portnoy aren't, you know, asked to not be part of a gaming license or a sports betting license going forward. I mean, that's the sort of the normal course of business, or it's their application is denied. I don't know. Like I said, I don't know what Kathy's going to do or commission's going to do, but certainly they're going to play it straight as they always do.
Let's talk about the kind of review that a gaming commission does. Can you tell us, I mean, you could probably define it better than I can, but what exactly is a suitability determination?
It's a review of every bit of business you've ever done, as well as every person you've ever done business with, going back without limitation to dates. And so I've been part of individual suitability, corporate suitability. I have been part of a due diligence. When GTEC was bought by an Italian firm, I was on the National Due Diligence Committee. And there's no end in sight to what we review and how we review it and who we review. There's no stone left unturned, no bank account left looked at, all of it. Like it's a review, like it's intense. And it's, well, they're never, who's ever happy about it, but that's life.
Well, I think the question with respect to Dave Portnoy will be whether he's a qualifier or not. They use a terminology in the Massachusetts Gaming Commission regulations, you know, persons who are required to be qualified, which I guess are, you know, subject to suitability review. Those are officers, inside directors, 10% or more beneficial owners of the applicant. He's none of those, but there are two catch-all categories. Any person with significant and substantial responsibility for the applicant's business or significant influence over decision-making. And then there's the, what I call the catch-all, which is other persons that have a business association of any kind with the applicant. And I think that language in, you know, 205 CMR 215 of the newly issued regulations give the Gaming Commission of Massachusetts the discretion to call Dave Portnoy forward as somebody to be qualified. Is he likely to face the same kind of scrutiny that Steve Wynn faced several years ago when the issue of the Wynn license was part of this like contentious, you know, hearing conducted by the Gaming Commission? Do you see that as a possibility here?
Oh, sure, certainly. And the thing about regs in Massachusetts is there's a period of comment, and I'm surprised none of the operators or would-be sports outfits oppose that language. Like, because there's in Mass, you have to publish your proposed regulations, and then there's a comment period. And then thereafter, they're promulgated and approved. The fact that no one opposed that very broad language, Dan, that you just read off in the CMRs, the Code of Mass Regs, kind of stuns me a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, I would imagine, given that analogy you just drew about Steve Wynn and his prolonged process through, I'd be shocked if they don't use that same process for Mr. Portnoy. It would surprise me.
Would he be required to testify in front of an open commission, or would this be conducted as part of a background investigation where he would have to speak with members of the commission and it wouldn't be part of an open public hearing?
Oh, I think that the second thing happens first. My guess is that they would review in private his business interests and attachments and relationships. But I don't know. I've never undergone a Mass Gaming Commission review, thankfully. I get to do my own. It made life easier, like I said, Dan, just having one shop to do business with, you know. For and sure. One of the nice things is previously, you know, when we licensed DraftKings, they were already licensed by I don't know how many other states. And so they were so prepared for what we are asking for. Like they had it basically in a couple of boxes. That's one of the things about these operators is the professionals know what you're looking for already and have it. It's like when a police officer pulls you over and you hand him your license and registration because you know that's what he's going to ask for. Similarly, like, I don't know if Barstool's ever been licensed anywhere or gone through the process a number of times. They're not the same level of just experience that DraftKings, a FanDuel, Caesars would have, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Penn National certainly has, and
well, of course,
Sportsbook has, but there's always been this sort of Chinese wall or this perception that Barstool Sports is the sports digital website. They're not the sports book. And Penn National and Barstool Sportsbook are the operators, right, of the digital and retail sports book. And the sports side or the Portnoy side has no influence over the operation or decision-making of the sports book. But at some point, they are in a way promoting the sports book. So does that constitute the kind of relationship that may not be operational control or decision-making, but are they closely affiliated enough where as a regulator, you would call them forward and want to have them be subject to suitability review?
I mean, certainly I would as a regulator, Dan, make that leap, okay, only because you're asking the consumer to have all of the benefits of the branding without any of the negative consequences.
Somebody scored a goal in the World Cup, by the way. I said the goal was scored.
I said, what happened? Argentina scored.
Excellent, excellent. I had my money on Argentina. I didn't bet, Charlie. I just had my figurative money, not the literal money. So,
So like you said, you're asking them, we want to have all the positive attributes of the brand without any of the negative attributes. You can't have it both ways, which is what Barstool is trying to do. Okay. They're saying, no, we're paying no attention to that man behind the curtain, you know?
What could Kathy do here? What could Commissioner Judd Stein do here? When you look at some of the factors, integrity, honesty, good character and reputation, financial stability and integrity, history of compliance with licensing requirements in other states. Hello, Ohio, by the way, associated with persons of disreputable character. There is enough discretion here where there could be a finding on either side of that line.
Exactly.
If he's qualified and gone through the suitability determination, what could the Massachusetts Gaming Commission do on a prospective basis, short of not granting an in-state casino a sports betting license, which seems so incomprehensible to me?
Yeah, I mean, for me, one of the things I've noticed in Mass is the number of operators that aren't showing up in Mass yet. We only had 5 applicants, right, for 6 untethered licenses. And the physical books want the foot traffic that a physical sports book draws. So if I recall correctly, I think Penn National has the rights to buy 100% of Barstool anyway, don't they?
Yeah, they own 36% now with the right to buy the full 100% in 2023. So by the time sports betting goes live in Massachusetts, they may be, or Barstool may be, a wholly owned subsidiary of Penn National.
Exactly. I mean, so they may try and solve the problem for the Mass Gaming Commission already. I don't know if it's worth that. I mean, certainly the brand is now less valuable to me with all this difficulty. As you know, when it comes to gambling, they try and avoid problems like the plague. Most gambling operators are not only try to be clean, they try and even look clean. And so I think they're going to do the review. I think Mass is going to dig in, and I'm guessing they'll probably solve the problem for them before it becomes a problem for the Mass Gaming Commission. Because I do know that, like I said, Kathy and that commission are as straight as it gets.
Charlie, thank you so much for spending some time with me on Conduct Detrimental and shedding light on, you know, the big unknown as to what faces Barstool, Penn Entertainment, and Dave Portnoy in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. That's going to be a major story over the next couple of weeks. So thank you for giving your perspective as the chief regulator in the state of New Hampshire. So I think this is a really good preview into what's to come with respect to the scrutiny that Barstool Sports faces.
All good, Dan. Never a dull moment when you get gambling, right?
Never, my friend. I love it. It's one of the best industries to follow. And thank you so much, Charlie. I hope you enjoy the rest of the World Cup. And I look forward to seeing you in person sometime very soon and paying off on that friendly wager we made about the timing of when Massachusetts would legalize sports betting. I lost that one by 2 years. So the interest adds up to a pretty expensive meal by now.
Well, I had a little inside knowledge to that point, Dan, you know?
For sure. I wouldn't say inside information, just insight into the process that I lacked. So
there you go.
Have a great rest of the day, Charlie. And we'll talk.
Thank you too. Best to you, wife, and good luck.
Thanks, Charlie.
That was Charlie McIntyre, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Lottery. Dan, great get. Anything that you did not hit on? Any kind of looming questions? What do we still have left to look for?
I would listen to everything Charlie said in the gaming industry. You know, these lottery officials and gaming regulators are very tight with one another. Charlie knows Commissioner or Chairwoman Judd Stein very well. She's the chairwoman of the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, Kathy Judd Stein. If anybody could provide a window into her thought process generally, it would be Charlie. And I think this is an excellent preview and insight into how this all-important licensing review is going to go on December 20th. Maybe it gets deferred to a later date, but Charlie is about as good as it gets if you want to have insight into what the Massachusetts Gaming Commission might be thinking as a possible resolution.
Okay, so let us move on to our second topic. Pretty two main topics. We have some other stuff to discuss at the end of the episode, but here's an interesting one, Dan, that came, you know, I saw this weird tweet. Our guest, Howard Balzer, who was on with us, one of our most popular episodes of all time, coming on to discuss the St. Louis Rams settlement. We did a fireside chat with him, you know, got aggregated on Reddit. That's how it got so popular, but story for another time. So I saw this weird tweet, Dan, by the name of Doug Samuels. You know, we'll shout him out. I think Howard references him in his article, which I imagine some of you are going to check out after. So I'm just going to read the tweet verbatim. Doug Samuels writes, and he's a guy that has a football blog. He's on Twitter. He writes, "There's an interesting situation brewing in Arizona, where fired offensive line coach Sean Klugler files request for arbitration and mentions possible, quote, mistaken identity." So nothing really wrong with that. I don't think that's a tweet that necessarily would get picked up. Why it does is the picture that's added. So there's a picture of Sean Klugler with his Arizona Cardinals hat on next to Steve Keim, the general manager of the Cardinals, who's recently taken a leave of absence from the team. So you can read the replies. You can read the quote tweets. Ian Rappaport from the NFL Network, he then quote tweets this tweet out from Doug Samuels. It's basically saying like Rappaport's got millions of followers. So Doug Samuels is not a guy that probably any of you have heard of, but people have heard of Ian Rappaport. So Rappaport, you know, quote tweets and puts this out into the next. So he really amplifies the Doug Samuels tweet. Why it's an issue, which Howard did a great job talking about in his article, and I'm sure you guys covered it as well. But this mistaken identity in the filing, we don't know what the mistaken identity is. We have no idea what it's intended to reference. Doug Samuels makes a leap, and other outlets also made the leap that, what could it be, a mistaken identity between Steve Keim and the offensive line coach? But at the end of this is some kind of ugly allegations of a groping incident while they were in Mexico City, the team. So, you know, Howard, you know, is a very opinionated guy. I'm sure he's going to be a fantastic guest. But yeah, I mean, it's a case that obviously, you know, we don't know quite exactly, you know, what the filing is. Could it be something akin to wrongful termination, a grievance against the league? You know, we'll see. But that's what's catching people's attention, this, quote, mistaken identity, quote, within the filing. Dan, Howard Balzer, good guest for this one. You saw his article. Is that why you thought to bring him on?
Yeah, I read his article where he was the only, forget journalist, he was the only person to suggest that this was an unfair leap to take based upon the verbiage, mistaken identity, which was buried as part of a longer sentence which said misunderstanding or mistaken identity. So he took umbrage from a journalism ethics point of view that he felt that this was irresponsible journalism to slap those pictures side by side where they look very similar and then take the misunderstanding quote and extrapolate from that what Seth Kugler is doing is basically throwing out there that Steve Keim was the one who committed the grope. And he made no such reference. And his law firm didn't make any reference of the sort in the press release. So we talk about that for a little while, but why this case intrigued me wasn't, you know, normally this is just, okay, an assistant coach gets terminated. What really made this an issue that got my attention and made me feel like there was some lack of justice or due process was precisely because there was a lack of due process here. You know, players that get accused of alleged offenses get an Article 46 conduct detrimental, you know, proceeding before a hearing officer and then ultimately before Roger Goodell. And with the Arizona Cardinals, we're going to talk about another coach just a few months before Seth Kugler got fired, who was accused of domestic violence, for which he is now doing 1 year in jail. And the Cardinals not only didn't fire him, they kept him on staff and they kept paying him until he was ultimately sentenced, covering a period of 5-6 months. So you're treating one assistant coach a certain way. And then Seth Kugler, who's been in the business for 30 years, has a sterling reputation, is gone just like that without even interviewing him, without any due process, without looking more closely at the facts, just on the basis of, you know, Mexican authorities said X, and now Seth Kugler's on a plane home to Phoenix and isn't even sticking around for the game. So that struck me as a very unusual set of circumstances. And when I read Howard's article, that prompted me to dive in a little bit more deeply. And Howard shed a lot of light on the mystery surrounding Sean Kugler against the backdrop of not the greatest show on turf, which were the St. Louis Rams, but dysfunction in the desert, which is an apt description for the Arizona Cardinals, who now are going through a total upheaval, quarterback out for the year, coaching change on the horizon, general manager who's on his way out. Basically, you have probably the most dysfunctional organization in the NFL in 2022. And I think this story was emblematic of what I think is a larger issue surrounding the Arizona Cardinals, but it's one that impacts Sean Kugler greatly. And I think it invokes, or at least provokes, my sense of outrage about the double standard.
People are wondering why Howard Balzer. Howard Balzer is a Hall of Fame selector. He was on with us to talk about the St. Louis Rams, who at one point it was the St. Louis Cardinals. So Howard Balzer has always been a Cardinals reporter, once in St. Louis, and now as a member, now he lives in Arizona. So good guess for both topics. And without further ado, I think we should kick it over to your conversation with the Howard Balzer.
We welcome back to Conduct Detrimental Howard Balzer, a friend of our podcast, going all the way back to the St. Louis Rams relocation saga that we covered extensively throughout September, October, November 2021. He now writes for Phoenix, PHNX. He's the Arizona Cardinals, an NFL reporter for Phoenix. Welcome back, Howard Balzer. How are you, Howard?
Hey, I'm doing well. Hope you're doing well also, and good to be with you.
Excellent to be with you. So now we have two Hofstra grads, you know, probably for the first time. Let's focus on the Sean, you know, Kugler firing, because that struck me as, you know, he's the second coach that has kind of gone out the door in 1 year. The first coach was a running back coach. James Saxon was accused or had been involved in some, you know, domestic violence incident where he allegedly struck a woman, and he's serving a year in jail. And the Cardinals knew about this incident going from May all the way to August. He kept his job. And when the revelations became public, that's when he went on an administrative leave. And it wasn't until the resolution of his criminal case that he was exited from the organization. So you got June, July, August, September, October. You got 5 full months where no adverse job action occurred to James Saxon. Why is Sean Kugler being treated differently? And could you go a little bit into the background surrounding what he's been accused of before we sort of bring it up to last week's, you know, case or allegation of mistaken identity?
Like you said, the way you framed it was perfect, because it was as if the Cardinals were hoping we only assume that they knew about it once the allegation was made in May. We assume that they knew about it. And if they did know about it, like you said, they chose to do nothing until it became public in early August, right in the first week of training camp. And so you wonder if what happened with Kugler, they were embarrassed by the way that situation developed and some of the hits they took for not doing anything, and thought, well, now we have an allegation and we have to do something immediately. Of course, you do put in the whole aspect that they were in Mexico City, in another country. There was, you know, the female security guard, apparently, that went to police and made these allegations. And then, boom, we find out that Sean Kugler has been sent home immediately from Mexico City, where they were preparing to play the San Francisco 49ers, and then was fired. And so certainly the embarrassment for the organization on a road trip, and which is, as everyone always characterizes them as, business trips, and that something like that happened on a business trip. So he was fired. Mm-hmm. We didn't hear very much about it, what was going on. Never heard if there were charges filed in Mexico City or any of those things until, like you said, this past week on Friday, when an employment law firm in Phoenix filed this request for arbitration and said that the words used were mysterious, that Kugler claimed that the team never even interviewed him or asked for his side, we don't know a lot of the steps, Daniel, that what happened. That apparently the police contacted the Cardinals and tell them that someone had said it was Sean Kugler, or did they tell him, hey, it was this, you know, guy with the Cardinals who was bald, you know, bald as a goatee. And so they just, did they just assume it was Sean Kugler? These are all questions that we have that we don't have answers to. And certainly from Kugler's standpoint, he's claiming it didn't happen, that he suggested that he said, be it a miscommunication or mistaken identity, I will cooperate with any investigation that the NFL does to get to the bottom of this. The Cardinals, of course, then responded saying that we are very confident in our reasons for terminating Sean Kugler, and we believe the facts will show that they were much different than from what Kugler has claimed in this press release that the law firm said sent, announcing this request for arbitration. And that's another, this is kind of a side story, Daniel. The request for arbitration, as many might not realize, is that when NFL employees sign contracts, they agree to arbitration in any disputes that might arise. And the league prefers it that way because you can have an arbitration behind closed doors that isn't public. And then some believe that the result will be what the league wants. And so that way, but this way, Sean Kugler could not file a civil lawsuit against the Cardinals because of the nature of his contract. And so that's just kind of a side issue to it all. But, you know, we'll see where it goes from here. But, you know, so many other things have developed from this. And then the alleged connection that some are putting out there that maybe it was Steve Keim, the general manager, who also is a, you know, white man, bald, with a goatee. And, of course, with Mexico City with the Cardinals for that trip.
That's what got my attention. I read your tweet, which led me to your Phoenix article that said some reactions to the Sean Kugler arbitration filing go beyond the boundaries of ethical journalism. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, it just seemed to be, at least as I read the press release from the law firm, the mistaken identity quote. It was a benign statement that was part of a lengthier sentence, which included maybe it's a misunderstanding or case of mistaken identity, the conjunctive or I don't know if that's a disjunctive or conjunctive, but it seemed to be a benign statement that some writers, and I even retweeted it, right? I didn't do the digging, and then you were the only one who called it out. So can you talk a little bit more about this quantum leap from a press release to like almost a false accusation?
Sure. Yeah. And what I called out wasn't what was said in there. I mean, both sides were presented with Sean Kugler's side and then the Cardinals. But then there were at least two people who tweeted it out and then jumped on the mistaken identity situation and then posted photos with the tweet of Steve Keim and Sean Kugler. And so then, of course, people look at that and say, oh, whoa, well, maybe, and again, it's maybe, and who knows, maybe it was Steve Keim. I mean, no one really knows, but that's not the point here. To wildly speculate and jump on that mistaken identity thing and then post the photos is, to me, a huge leap in terms of what is responsible journalism. Now, let's be honest. I mean, certain levels of ethical journalism have been out the door for a long time, and I'm an old school guy. When it used to be that when you work for a newspaper, you couldn't print anything unless you had two sources for it. Now things are just thrown out there crazy. But, you know, speculation when someone says leaked sources say, and now they're saying that now that Steve Keim, because of this medical leave, won't be back with the team. Well, in some ways, that's fair game. But when you put those photos up there, when you have no evidence whatsoever that this was the case, it just seemed over the top to me. And then the funniest one, what really was, one of the people who put it out on Twitter also put photos there, had a different photo of Sean Kugler where he was wearing glasses and had a ball cap on. And it, when you looked at that, there would be no way you would say, oh, well, gosh, they look exactly the same. I mean, or at least close, you know, being similar. So it wasn't even a good picture that was chosen to try to support this wild speculation. And so then on top of it, Daniel, Ian Rappaport, who has over 3.7 million followers, he retweeted the one with the bad picture. And his tweet was just, presenting the Cardinals' statement. And so before I wrote the story on gophnx.com, I spoke to Ian. I wanted to get his side of it. And he, I did that. And I said, well, why did you feel it was important to retweet something with those photos? And he says, well, I was just trying to provide context and present both sides of the story with the Cardinals' statement. And I said, well, Ian, you could have just put the statement on your own tweet. And then if you wanted to include what the allegations were against him, you could have done that. But by putting the photos, that, and he actually said to me, he says, well, no one's going to look at that and believe it to be true. I said, really? In this atmosphere of level of discourse that there is for whatever it is in our country, whether it's sports, politics, whatever it is, that something outlandish is not going to be believed? So when I said that, he says, yeah, I guess I see your point.
In Arizona, especially, right? You're in the midst of this, you know, governor electoral lawsuit battle over whether there were irregularities or not.
Yeah, exactly. So in fact, I had a tweet the night before, incidentally, I had a tweet the night before because there were all these nasty comments. And sometimes I think I shouldn't even read all this stuff on Twitter. But that's it's what it's become in a lot of respects. And so I tweeted the night before because there'd been a lot of nasty comments directed by fans against Keim, about Keim and Kyler Murray. I said, oh, you know, you can say you don't like the job Steve Keim has done. That's fair game. But some of the stuff is just like out there and downright nasty. So I said, it's not surprising that there have been these nasty comments about Keim and Murray when among us, there are people that believe COVID was a hoax, January 6th were tourists visiting the Capitol, and that the Holocaust didn't happen. And I could have listed 10 other things in the tweet. And so, unfortunately, to a certain degree, that's our level of discourse. Yep. By these tweets, it's the level of what, and I put, when I use the word journalism, I put it in quotes, because there are no journalistic boundaries for many websites and for many people who just post whatever they want. There's no accountability.
We've seen that a lot recently on Twitter.
We were talking it was in my story. We were talking in the locker room at the Cardinals facility Friday afternoon. And one of the writers said to me, if I had put that tweet out there with those photos, I would have been fired or at the least suspended for a certain amount of time. Because there's accountability. There's someone above you that is saying, hey, this is not right. You can't do this. But a lot of the stuff that gets out there, there is no true accountability.
So what evidence do the Arizona Cardinals actually have against Sean Coogley? Was it just simply the Mexican police saying, hey, your assistant coach groped a security guard? Because there was some, I guess, tweets from Mr. Rappaport once again earlier this morning in which he said that there were videotapes. I mean, he was like caught dead to rights. And it raises the question of what, if any, investigation did the Arizona Cardinals actually conduct here? I mean, do you know? I mean, I don't know. It just seems like a lot of rumor and innuendo.
We don't know. And when I say we, it's out there publicly. Certainly the Cardinals believe that they have the evidence. And let's be realistic here. Ian Rappaport, right, works is paid by the NFL. And so in that connection, part of his paycheck comes from the Arizona Cardinals. So would it be a leap of faith or a leap of judgment or a leap or whatever you want to call it to say that he probably got that information from someone from the Cardinals, that there are videotapes and that they have him dead to right? But other than that, we don't know, because he obviously doesn't say who the source is, what it totally showed, but he's saying that, you know, they have this information. Wouldn't have come out with as strong a statement as they did unless they totally believed that they had all the information in hand. And maybe they felt if they had this videotape, they didn't need to interview Sean Coogler, as he alleges that they did not do. And the thing you wonder, and I like to even do this, the thing you wonder is, did Sean Coogler put in there about the mistaken identity in some way, hoping that that path would lead to Steve Keim? I mean, who knows? I mean, you can speculate on anything these days, but without the real facts, that's, and what I just did is wild speculation. But would it surprise anyone if that was the case? And does he know that they have video? Well, if he's never talked to him, he might not know that they have this evidence. And if they do have this evidence, he's going to look, he'll end up looking even worse in the long run.
That's what leads me to believe that, listen, when you look at Sean Coogler's history as an NFL coach. He's been in this business for 30 years. He's been affiliated with NFL teams going all the way back to 2001, 21 years, head coach at UTEP. He's got two sons in the business. He's got one son who's an assistant O-line coach at the Carolina Panthers. He's got another who's the offensive line coach at University of Maine. He's a very well-liked individual, popular, you know, with the players. He's got a track record, 30-year track record. And overnight, on the basis of no investigation, just, you know, one accusation made by Mexican police. Maybe there's some videotape evidence, but you don't actually conduct an investigation or talk to the coach, and you're going to flush down or flush out his entire 30-year career without affording him the type of due process and benefit of the doubt that Michael Bidwell accorded James Saxon and also accorded Brett Kavanaugh 4 years ago when he led this movement to sign a letter with Brian Cashman and all these other high school classmates vouching for a U.S. Supreme Court nominee at the time, Brett Kavanaugh, yet Kugler gets absolutely no due process and no chance to make his case.
No, that's the big about all this. And why didn't the Cardinals, okay, they get this allegation and they say, they go to Sean Kugler and they say, we've had this allegation. Mm-hmm. And what does he say about it? And then maybe you send him home and you say, okay, best for you to leave the team now, but we will continue to investigate this until we are truly satisfied. And so you would think that would be the way that you would handle it. Unless, like I said earlier, they felt embarrassed by the James Saxon situation. And they felt at that moment, they made this decision that they had the information they needed to do it the way they did. This was allegedly, the game was on Monday night in Mexico City. This supposedly happened at some point on Sunday. And so when they were told about it, we don't know. We believe it was Sunday. And you'd like to think that if someone came to them and say, hey, we have this allegation from someone that your offensive line coach groped the security guard, you know, and you would like to think they say, well, hold it. You know, anybody can say anything in this atmosphere today. You know, what evidence do you have? And then you go from there. And so, but all those details, we don't know. I realize sometimes when you have litigation, you can't say too much, but it leads to speculation. It leads to, well, maybe it was this, maybe it was that, maybe it was something else. And that's the unfortunate result sometimes, either not being fully transparent or feeling that you can't be for whatever reason.
Yeah, well, he's fighting back. I mean, if he was, you know, guilty and had no, you know, everything was caught on videotape, I don't think he would be hiring at his own expense a top rated, you know, Phoenix employment attorney to represent him at great cost to himself. He's fighting for his career. And, you know, I would think the leave of absence, conducting an investigation, that would be the bare minimum. I mean, these coaches don't have a CBA with the NFL where they get the Article 46 semblance of due process that players get, nor did he get anywhere, nothing close to resembling what James Saxon got. So I'm going to be following this story because I sense, you know, a due process or, you know, sort of a process flaw here, as well as an issue of selective enforcement. You know, you're treating them differently than you've treated others within the organization, especially similarly situated coaches on the same side of the ball. So to me, unless you know, he's on, you know, videotape, I don't know how you prove his guilt, but we know what the ultimate end result is going to be because this is a forum in which the judge is paid by the owner of the Arizona Cardinals and the other 31 NFL teams. So I think we can predict what the ultimate or eventual outcome is going to be, unfortunately, at least in the NFL side of things.
No, exactly. And that was when we were talking about when you have this in arbitration. And heck, we know when we talked last during that whole lawsuit that the NFL with the St. Louis lawsuit tried to have it settled by arbitration. For what? How long was that process? Maybe a year or two of just going through the different courts to try to get it in arbitration so it wouldn't be in a courtroom.
They went to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they took it all the way to the Supreme Court, hoping that they could get this adjudicated in an arbitration as opposed to, you know, a courtroom. Yeah. And so, but obviously St. Louis was suing. They're not under contract to the NFL like a coach or any other employee.
Yeah, but maybe, you know, I know we're probably reaching the end of our segment, but there is always a point of judicial entry because even arbitration decisions can be challenged in federal court on the basis of, you know, the contrary against the manifest disregard of the law, some kind of procedural deficiency. I know the contracts for the coaches say full final adjudication by the commissioner. The NFL Constitution says that, but there's always a way to get into federal court if you think you've been railroaded during the arbitration right. process. And I'm really fascinated by this case because it just strikes me as, you know, on the surface, a very curious way to treat somebody in rapid fire fashion without any investigation whatsoever. So Howard, I look forward to having you back. You've been our favorite guest on Conduct Detrimental. You, to this date, you've set the record for the most downloaded single podcast when we had you on doing the history of football in St. Louis. So where can our audience members find you today? I know I mentioned the PHNX website, but can you give us a few more details on how they could follow you there and subscribe to your analysis of the football world and the Cardinals beat?
Yeah, you can go directly to gophnx.com. It is a local website, so mostly it's all content about the Phoenix sports teams. And of course, people can follow me on Twitter at HBALZER721. And whether it's on the Cardinals or the NFL, or you never know what you're going to see on there from me. So that's the best way to find me. And also for the listeners of Sirius XM NFL Radio, I do a weekly show on the Pro Football Hall of Fame with Joe Harrigan, who works for the Hall of Fame. And I'm honored to be one of the 49 selectors each year for the class. So that's once a week on NFL Radio on Sirius XM.
All right. Well, Howard, thank you very much for joining us today to talk about the Sean Coogler and the Arizona Cardinals, you know, I guess, saga in one of the most dysfunctional years in the team's history. Three arrests, one leave of absence, one, you know, torn ACL, and maybe a complete new management team.
Yeah, who knows? Actually, two torn ACLs because Zach Ertz tore his ACL. He had a PEDs. DeAndre Hopkins. That's why I say, I mean, when I was writing the story a couple of weeks ago, I was writing it all down, just making notes, trying to make sure I didn't forget anything. I mean, that's how crazy this entire calendar year has been for the Cardinals. And I'm sure the owner, Michael Bidwell, is going to be happy in about 14 days when the calendar turns to 2023. But he's got some big decisions ahead of him in terms of the direction of this franchise.
For sure. Well, as long as the writers stay healthy, that's the important thing. So Howard, we'll talk to you soon. And thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time as always.
My pleasure, Daniel. Take care. Have a good holiday season, a good new year.
So that was Howard Balzer. Dan, once again, Howard tends to deliver for Conduct Detrimental.
Yeah, we can pretty much take the episode off whenever Howard joins us because he really sets the stage very effectively, tells such great stories, and has such a, you know, command of the facts of this case. So it was really insightful to listen to. And of course, I always enjoy Howard's company. He's one of the best, you know, historians of the modern age of the NFL, but he's also one of the most important journalists today. And going all the way back to, you know, the beginning of when I started to become a follower of the off the field side of the National Football League. Very few people are on Howard's level. So we were lucky to get him again. And hopefully this story will have some transparency around it. And maybe we don't find out the results until after the NFL announces its ruling in the arbitration case, at which point maybe, Dan, it ends up in federal court, as a lot of these arbitration proceedings tend to go with the party who wins wanting to confirm the arbitration award and the non-prevailing party wanting to vacate the arbitration award. So this might be a year or so wait before we have some interim level of finality, and then the federal court lawsuit will follow.
Those are our main two topics. Just a couple loose ends to hit. Probably one of our last episodes of the year of 2022. Some good news. I don't know if we'll post this on social, but you guys, our listeners, can hear it. A big thank you to all of you. We just hit lifetime downloads. Dan and I think you and I've done maybe just over 100 episodes together. You did obviously, I think about 50 with Whirly. Damn, we've hit just over 300,000 downloads. Isn't that pretty crazy?
I feel sorry for anybody who has to listen to those all in a row.
300,000. Yeah. 300,000. That is a wild number, but we don't take it for granted. So I don't know. We get the metrics. We don't share all the stuff, but wanted to thank you for that. If you're listening now, being a small part of it, we really, truly appreciate it. I just have two things pretty quick, Dan. The story that we've covered a couple times, I've done probably more of it on social media, but Aaron Judge, we brought on Ezra Levine, who is a collectibles expert, his own company called Collectibles. He was on the podcast maybe about a month ago saying if he was advising this individual who caught the Aaron Judge 60-second home run ball, he probably would have said to put that ball to auction much sooner, right? Take advantage of the goodwill. The Yankees playoff chase at that time, maybe you get somebody that wants to see, you know, have the Judge ball and maybe the Yankees win the World Series. The ball doesn't go up for auction, Dan, and it just finished. You know, we're recording this on December 19th. So Judge hit his home run ball the first week of October. So how many days go by? About 75 days go by before the final auction of this, before the hammer slams, as they speak. So the ball, Dan, sells for $1.5 million. Now, you and I are not going to cry a river for someone that caught a ball at a game and turned it into $1.5 million. But you and I are here to talk about potential legal issues, right? I'm sure there's going to be a big story written on this at some point in time. This individual that caught the ball was allegedly offered $3 million. And that was my understanding was it was a standing offer up until December. And he turned down the $3 million that he was offered for this ball on the same day that he announced it's going to be putting it up for auction. So you'd assume someone gave him some advice that said, hey, turn down the $3 million because you're probably going to get more than $3 million, maybe four, maybe five. That's not what happened, as we joke on Twitter, right? Assumption of the risk. You obviously knew that was a potential chance. But Dan, the ball going for 1.5, my antennas are going up. I'm not sure if there's a legal case in here, but if someone gave him some advice that said, wait until December, wait until there's no more baseball games, wait until the middle of free agency. Wouldn't shock me if there is some litigation resulting from this event. It certainly wouldn't shock me.
Well, it would shock me because the man who caught the home run ball is not some, rube, off the street. I think he's a very successful investment advisor. And he comes from the world of finance. So it would be a stretch, at least for me, for someone with a sophisticated financial background to say that he relied on the advice of either an attorney or somebody else and tries to lay blame at that person's feet. I don't think not only will a jury never buy it, it would never even get to a jury. It would never even get to a jury. I think unless you have, some kind of guarantee or, expert report that's based on flawed methodology, I'd have a hard time believing that someone with that level of sophistication, education, being part of the industry where you value things and place valuations on assets would say he was the subject of some, horrid advice.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, let's hope that was the case, that he was advised by someone. He, signed all that. This is why, Dan, you and I are kind of jumping to the finish line. But that's why you sign releases. That's why you sign with Golden's Auction. You sign that there's no minimum reserve. That's why you sign all of that stuff away. Assuming you dot all those I's and cross all those T's, yeah, you're probably safe. But I'm hoping, because Dan, in my limited conversations with people in the sports collectible universe before the hammer came down, I was told by I don't know, on good authority that the handling of this ball was done in a non-traditional way, given all the different factors at play, that it was done in a very risky way. So as long as the guy was aware of that and he subscribed to those risks, so be it. But again, just pointing it out there, just flagging potential things.
Dan, this is a guy who's probably well off to begin with. He made $1.5 million, and I'm not going to cry for him. I'm not going to feel bad for him. It's a life-changing amount for probably 95% or maybe 99% of, the population of the United States. It's not a life-changing amount for him. And as a result, whatever he can get for the ball, that's fine. But he's not somebody whose life was adversely impacted by the diminution in value. He had the right. He had the ability to make a decision. He decided a little bit too late, just like I decided a little bit too late to lease a car, 1 year after the price has begun to precipitously, rise. So again, we're talking about a magnitude that is such a once in a lifetime thing that it's not something that is going to affect most of our lives. It was a lucky, he was in the right place at the right time, and he's already a millionaire probably, and he became $1.5 million richer. And that to me is the story, not what he sacrificed.
We'll see. We will see. I'm just flagging things, but yeah. Okay. The other one I want to hit pretty quick, just so we're aware, so everyone's aware of it. We bash the NCAA a lot on, I tend to do it a little bit less, given my current role that I'm at now, but Mark Emmert is now out. They've announced a replacement to Mark Emmert that's going to occur in March of 2023. That is current governor of Massachusetts. someone by the name of Charlie Baker. You can look him up, but he has announced that he is not seeking a third term. So he'll basically be done. And I think the way the timing lines up, like January 2023, and he'll start with the NCAA in March of 2023. So it's a big name hire. We'll see what comes of it. We've been, at least, you know, those in the space have been saying, when is the NCAA going to make a move? Why are they waiting? Why have they not had any type of enforcement or real any type of teeth in this entire NIL era? There's a potential school of thought that they were waiting for the new guy to take over, and that new guy would lead them in the direction, in his particular vision. So there is hope. There is hope on the college sports space that Charlie Baker will be an improvement on previous eras, and maybe he'll have a real mark. I mean, this is not someone, I think, at least as of today, hopefully old takes exposed doesn't get us on this, but it doesn't seem like someone that's hired as a figurehead hire. It seems like someone that you put into this position to enact some level of change. So I don't know what the future of the NCAA will be, but it's a big hire. It is a big name hire, friend of the show. You know, Michael McCann is posting pictures with Charlie Baker. So he seems to have some good sports law ties. Yeah. Let's say this might be positive. We'll say I'm cautiously optimistic.
Dan, I think it's a great hire. The governor of Massachusetts was hired for one specific reason in mind, I think, which is to bring the NCAA into the 21st century and have a real pragmatic approach to NIL, to sports betting. You have to remember, he's the governor who signed into law the sports betting bill that would allow for wagering on collegiate sporting events. The NCAA has been against the notion of any involvement of colleges, any authorized betting on collegiate games. So I think Governor Baker, while he originally wanted an outright ban on collegiate sports wagering, ultimately agreed to a compromise approach. So I think he's a problem solver who will come up with a good solution on the sports betting question, as well as probably help champion a federal approach to name, image, and likeness. And his relationships across the spectrum, he's a Republican governor in a Democratic state, speaks well or bodes well for his ability to make friends across party lines and to broker compromises. So I think this ultimately will put NIL on a faster track towards federal legislation. Definitely not a fast track. I like Charlie Baker's chances, given the work that I've seen from a distance and given his reputation, inside the sports world, as well as throughout the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, just a five-star hire.
Okay, Dan, I guess I'll keep our eyes on those issues, but great episode. That'll do it for another episode of Conduct Detrimental. Again, it's been a great year for our site. Big shout outs, for our platform across any number of local national media outlets. So we do not ever take it for granted. Thank you for being with us on this long haul. Dan, a happy holidays to you. And yeah, that'll do it for us over here. For Dan Wallach, myself, our entire Conduct Detrimental team, we'll see you all next time on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.